Okay, I am here with Sam Chauncey, one of the founders of the International Festival for Arts and Ideas, and he has graciously consented to talk a little bit about those early years and the genesis of the festival.
I should qualify your use of the word founders, because there really were three founders, and that were, it was Gene Handley and Roz Meyer and Ann Calabresi. But I was one of the first people that they called, because I knew them all personally, and I was at that by that time secretary of the university, and they called me to come and meet with them at the Graduate Club on Elm Street, and they presented this idea of a festival of, it was only said to be a festival of arts, and it was modeled after the Edinburgh Festival that had been going on for many years, and it was later that they arrived at the idea of adding the ideas section to make it somewhat different. But they clearly invited me to see what I would be willing to offer from Yale in order to help this organization get going. I was very interested in it, and I, among other things, agreed to serve on the first board, which I did. And I can't remember, I think I probably served for 10 years, which is when I left as secretary, so I'm just guessing I served for the first 10 years, but I'm not sure the exact number of years. You know, history will record that New Haven may be a sort of unique place in the number of women who have been movers and shakers in the community at a time when women were generally not leaders, because I'm going to come back to the three founders, but New Haven has had four women, each of whom had a father who had started a company here in New Haven, each of whom had an older brother who would, by historic ways, had become the CEO of the company when the father stepped aside. And in each case, it was the younger sister who became the CEO. And the three companies were the Pierce Real Estate Firm, where Herb Pierce was the founder and his daughter Barbara succeeded him. Cohen Brothers Paint Company, and when he died or retired, I've forgotten which it was, Betsy Henley Cohen, and not her older brother, became the head of it. The Fusco Construction Company, and when Eddie Fusco stepped down, his daughter Lynn became the head. And then Mary Jane Burt, who is no longer head of it because she sold it, but her father started the Burt Pharmaceutical Medical Laboratories that does, you know, when you have your blood taken and they do the testing. That was later sold to Quest. But Mary Jane became the president instead of her older brother. So there was a period in New Haven when the civic leadership was dominated by women, because those four women not only were head of their companies, but they took an active role in the city of New Haven. Jean Handley had been the first woman officer of the Southern New England Telephone Company. And the Southern New England Telephone Company was a baby bell that was not controlled by AT&T. It was self-contained and a very strong company. And for example, when the president of the company, Al Van Sinderen, went to the Quinnipiac Club and said, "We've just appointed a new vice president by the name of Jean Handley and we'd like her to become a member," they said, "No, we don't take women." And so Mr. Van Sinderen very politely told them that they would no longer get any business, and they were right next door to each other. So every day, everyone was over there eating and entertaining. So they changed their mind and took people. Roz Meyer, of course, came from a very wealthy New York family, the Milstein family, the big real estate family. And she had a lot of money, but she had a presence. She's a big, tall woman, and she is not afraid to say what she thinks. So you can tell she was brought up in that powerful family in New York. And Ann Calabresi comes from a impeccable Midwestern family, the Crosbys and the Pillsbury. She's a product of both families, and that's General Mills and Pillsbury Mills put together. And it's a family where people have always spoken their minds. And so here you had these three women to whom it was almost impossible to say no about anything. So I volunteered as much of Yale as I could, but I also saw it as I was, because it's just about the time, a little bit later, that I'm starting my community relations program and trying to get a really good program going, and saw it as something that Yale could invest in that was non-controversial, because everything we wanted to support in our community relations program, somebody would have a reason why it was either politically unwise or socially unwise or something like that. But this one seemed to be absolutely neutral. So I loved the idea. In the beginning, it was a festival that was not very strong. I mean, I think the first one was 4 or 5 days long. I can't remember how long it was. And there wasn't a lot that was really wonderful, but it was able to build up a head of steam and keep going despite never having the kind of financial support it really ought to have. We always thought that if we got it going, that United Technologies or one of the big pharmaceutical firms downstate would come in and put their name on it and give millions of bucks. It never was able to attract that. Despite, you know, we did all kinds of studies about the ripple, economic ripple effect and all that kind of stuff. Never could get anywhere. But suffice it to say that more than the founding board, it was the spirit of those three women and the tenacity with which they worked on it that made it work. And then we had a genius by the name of Paul Collard. And I can't tell you, you'll find out in the history, but I think he was the third, there was a woman who did it in the beginning who knew nothing about festivals, and then there was a woman who wasn't too strong. And then Paul came in, he was a Scotsman who had, I think, been involved in the Edinburgh Festival, I'm not sure. But he was the one who got it going to the level at which it is now in terms of creativity and interesting programs and ideas programs and so on.
When did the ideas piece of it come in?
You're going to have to look at the pieces of paper, but I would say it was certainly not till the end of the first year or somewhere in there, maybe the second year, but I'm not good at pinpointing exact times. Mm-hmm. But I think it's turned out to be a very important part of the program, and a very good part. Mm-hmm. That's what I remember.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the pace of growth over the years?
Yeah. Yale and the state, Southern New England Telephone Company, the Sargent Company. And a couple of other, and the banks, Connecticut Savings Bank, the New Haven Savings Bank, First Bank, they kept it going financially. And the state in particular, if my memory is correct, it was getting what are called economic development grants from the state, annual things, mm-hmm. So much money. However, it wasn't just money. You had to have enough creative leadership in order to get performances, music, drama, ideas that could attract people to a place that for 40 years had been a no-no ground. In 1970, there was an article in the New Yorker magazine that portrayed New Haven as the worst small city in the United States. The most unsafe, the most unstable, the most, you name the bad word, and it was drug-filled, whatever it was. Yale was deeply concerned about that because if you're trying to recruit faculty and students and the word is that this is a lousy place to live, you're not going to do very well. So secondly, and this is still true today, I know friends I have in Woodbridge or Bethany or Orange who I have invited to come to New Haven and have dinner with me at a restaurant who say, I wouldn't go to downtown New Haven at night if you paid me. Well, in 1970, 75, in that period, 80, that was the... Nobody would come to New Haven, particularly at night. So you not only had to have creative performances and ideas that would attract intelligent people or interested people and local people, but you had to convince people it was okay to be here at night. Because most of these things occur, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening. So the struggle was, first of all, the money, but I think in a way the money was the easiest part. Mm-hmm. I think getting a creative director who really understood something about, I think the first year that Paul Collard was running it, there was a Polish theater group who did Romeo and Juliet in Polish with no... They didn't have those sort of translator things that you have nowadays. It was spectacular. I mean, everybody knows a little bit about Romeo and Juliet. So you went in there, and people were speaking a language that virtually no one in the room knew how to speak, and you knew what was going on, and it was wonderful.
It's like opera.
Yeah, it's absolutely magnificent. So that creative instinct was the second most difficult, and to me the third most difficult was to convince people to walk into this city mm-hmm. and onto that green or into the Schubert or, you know, wherever it was, and just getting them to come here. Mm-hmm. I think we're almost over that hill now. The creativity part, I think, has been done wonderfully, and the I'm afraid of New Haven part is disappearing. But you still get the money. And maybe the money now becomes more of a problem than it was in the early days. Because Southern New England Telephone, all the banks, Sargent, they've all gone, essentially. And so that Yale's still paying a big chunk of the bill, and so's the state of Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. How important do you think the festival has turned out to be for the city?
You're talking to a zealot when it comes to the city of downtown. I've always lived in the downtown New Haven. It is second most important, in my view, to something else, and that is a plan we started after that New Yorker article, which was to forget about recruiting Fortune 500 companies to come to New Haven. And we set a goal, this is a group of us, private citizens, called the Downtown Council. We set a goal to have 40,000 people to live in the downtown area, excluding Yale. And this summer we will have achieved that. You've seen the apartments being built all over the place. We'll have 40,000 people living in downtown. I think that's the single most important thing, because that means that at nighttime there are people walking the streets. It means that there will be pressure on the Board of Aldermen and the Mayor to do things that are important for the downtown, make it stronger and healthier, and you know, whether it's plowing the streets or keeping the crime down. But I think the festival is maybe the second most important thing that has occurred to make New Haven a little distinctive from other communities. And if they can keep the money coming in, I'm convinced that the creative side will be there mm-hmm. and that the hostility towards the city itself will have gone away.
So are those people from Woodbridge and Bethany, are they making their way into New Haven now for the...
Yes, they are. They are. I mean, I haven't heard that remark in the last couple of years you hear it once or twice, you hear somebody say that and you want to kick them in the teeth because they're so stupid. But no, I think that hostility is going away. Uh-huh. The restaurants have done it. If nothing else, the restaurants have done a lot. And you add that to the festival and the ongoing rep, Schubert-Long Wharf combination and the museums and so on, music, symphony. I think that's a big part of it, too. But the festival's part of that. I mean, the festival is a enhancement of an ongoing activity. That is, we have music, we have art, we have ideas, we have these things going on at a much lower key, and then all of a sudden for 3 weeks we gear it up and really hit them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's working.
Mm-hmm. The pop-up festivals in the neighborhoods, this year there was one in Fairhaven, one in Dixwell, one on the Hill.
Mm-hmm.
How long have those been going?
Well,
do you know?
Somebody had the idea way back in the beginning that we ought to have we all were talking about, you know, we had so many empty storefronts in New Haven then that we ought to take empty storefronts and have pop-up things, whether it was an art exhibit or a
right.
talk or something like that. And I think that's where the idea of the pop-up festivals, I can't tell you when what we now know as those things actually began, but the first year we tried something in a storefront and I don't think it worked, whatever it was. And so the idea has been there since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody agreed that to just have the festival and then pretend nothing else was going on was a mistake. You wanted to try to keep some continuity going. I think that's something that can be enhanced, although as you know, the Audubon Street area, the arts area, what I call the arts area, has been very strong in New Haven. The various schools, the Creative Arts Workshop and the Neighborhood Music School, and those they're pretty strong places. And we're beginning to get some of the minority groups involved in some of those things in a way that they weren't before, and that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's healthy, I think.
Yeah. Great. Is there anything you want to add?
I could probably go on for 3 or 4 more hours, but I'll spare you that. No, I don't think there's anything in it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.